Keep in touch with the Wolf Connection podcast on our Instagram handle at the Wolf Connection Pod, or email us your questions, comments, and guest ideas to podcast@wolfconnection.org. Thank you for your support, and howls to you all. Welcome to the Wolf Connection podcast. I'm your host, John Calvin. So another reach out via our Instagram for this particular podcast, and very excited to have these two individuals here because it is talking about the works of a legend. Really no pun intended there in any way, shape, or form. And we are talking about the works of Rick McIntyre, but these two gentlemen have been tabbed with penning a script and bringing those stories to the screen. And they are Will Stenberg, who is a Wolf advocate, writer, musician, and Zach Stentz. You may know him as a writer and a film producer on such films as X-Men First Class and Thor in the TV version of The Flash. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to meet you both, and thank you guys for joining us. How are you doing?
We're doing great, and so great to be talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Doing great.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and again, thank you, Will, for starting the conversation and to getting this thing going. Just quick before we jump into the major thing that we're going to talk about, just I'll start with you, Will. Give everybody a little bit of background, and we'll go to you, Zach, after that. Where did you grow up initially? Where did this love for the outdoors come from? Because I was reading a little bit of background on both of you, and you're avid outdoor, lovers of the outdoors. Like I said in your intro, wolf advocacy is one of your things. Will, where does all that come from? Was that at a young age, or did that grow over time?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if this was evident because we have different last names, but Zach and I are brothers. So some of what I say will probably apply to him, but we grew up in a really remote part of Northern California. In Mendocino County. I don't know if you guys have been there, but it's in the Redwood Forest on the coast. It's really hard to get to and hard to get out of. So I grew up in the country. And I think as a young person, I kind of rejected it. So when I turned 18, I wanted to get out of my small town and get away from rural life. And I spent a lot of time in urban areas. But just recently, as I've hit my early 40s, I've found myself really returning to my roots, and I'm now living in a cabin on a river about 30 minutes south of Portland, Oregon, fishing and hiking and kayaking. And I think it's just in your blood when you grow up a certain way. And I haven't been able to shake it. So I guess that says it for me.
Totally. Yeah. Zach, what about you? Same deal or a little bit different, even though you guys are brothers?
No, growing up in a little town in the Pacific Northwest and, being on the cross country team where your daily run wouldn't be on a golf course or on city streets, but out a logging road to a swimming hole, in the middle of the Redwood Forest. Is an experience. It's just, the outdoors is what's right outside of your house. And even having lived in Los Angeles for 25 years, I'm pretty much out every weekend, either in the Santa Monica Mountains or the San Gabriel Mountains with some combination of kids and dogs, exploring different hiking trails and things like that. So the outdoors continues to be a big part of my life.
For you, Zach, and then we'll go over to you, Will. What are there any activities? Because you guys spoke about fishing and hiking and cross country running when you were younger. Are there any certain activities or places in the natural world that inspire you that as you've gone along in your life journey that inspire writing, inspire you music, Will? Like, what are some of the things or places even that really stick close to home and really resonate with you?
For me, nothing beats home. Nothing beats the Redwoods. It's hard to put it into words. John Steinbeck did it a lot better than I ever could. But and the Pacific Ocean, I literally grew up on the coast, so it was outside the window, more or less. So I have to return, even though I'm not quite on the coast now, I have to return there fairly regularly for spiritual sustenance. But bodies of water in general, I can see the Willamette River outside my window right now, and there's something that's nourishing about bodies of water. Um, So yeah, I guess I'm a like rivers and the ocean for me.
Yeah, it's kind of the same for me. It's there was an experience I had when I was out of the country for the first time in my life, right when I graduated from college. I was in southern England due to a strange series of circumstances, but I remember feeling so homesick, and I was out taking a walk on this kind of typically rainy day in Great Britain. And all of a sudden, I just had this overwhelming feeling of being at home, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I looked around me and realized someone decades before had planted a grove of redwood trees there, and they had taken root and grown. And the smell of them, especially the smell of them in the rain, was hitting me, and was just creating this incredible sensory feeling of being at home. So that's definitely it's definitely my home bioregion that that keeps calling me back.
That's awesome.
Coming from a small town, it's sometimes the thing that is hard to conceptualize is that you can pursue a career in the arts in the first place, and you can actually even do that for a living. And I think it helps when someone exposes themselves as an example that you can do this and you can take the risk to do it. Was there someone in your lives who served as that inspiration or that example?
I think Zach should start with that one.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't. I had to be that person. I had to be that person myself. And you know, my childhood in the 19, you know, I had a very 1980s childhood. And if you've seen the film Super 8, it was very much like that. It was taking the friend's 8mm movie camera and going out in the woods and dressing in costumes and making our own little war movies or our own little like Dungeons and Dragons movies. You know, and then in senior, you know, like senior year of high school, we managed to get a hold of, you know, the AV club's video equipment, and then we would make movies with that and show them on the public access, the local public access, TV station. But that was never something, you know, it was something I did because it was creatively fulfilling, and because I had to, not because I ever thought I was going to make a living at it. I actually my degree is actually in journalism, and I worked full time as a journalist for probably my first 7 or 8 years after college. And I was writing screenplays as a hobby that whole time, but it took, you know, like I was doing something else for a living when I finally managed to break into this very bizarre and difficult industry.
It's true.
Yeah, and for me, not to get too mushy about it, but it was him. That was my inspiration. Zach and I are 10 years apart. The gray beard might throw you off, but I'm younger. And so, you know, by the time I was 10 years old, he was in college, and he'd left most of his stuff at home, where I was living with my little brother and our mom. And so it was all his, you know, tapes of, you know, punk rock music and 80s like college rock and his Dungeons and Dragons books and, you know, this whole and his VHS tapes and this whole world of art and culture that would not have been accessible to me otherwise. So yeah, for me
Awesome.
it was my brother.
That's cool, man.
That's such a great man. What a journey, you guys. That's so awesome. Let's get into the thing. Many of you that are listening to this episode, I'm sure, have either heard our podcast, met Rick McIntyre, read his books, and maybe taken a few photos alongside him in Yellowstone. For both of you, I guess we'll go Zach and then Will. How did this opportunity come about?
It is a really interesting, it is a very interesting series of circumstances, actually. It started with Will, and it started with Will writing something on his Facebook wall about Wolf 21, and that he had gotten from I don't think from directly from Rick's books, but from the interviews that he was giving, to promote the books, there were a lot of articles being written. And it just, you know, because those stories are so incredibly compelling, it just stuck with me. And I went down a kind of rabbit hole of research into Rick's stories of the Wolves of Yellowstone. And it led to me doing a Twitter thread about Wolf 20, the life and death of Wolf 21, that unexpectedly went super viral. And to the degree that all of the sudden it put all of his books on the bestseller list at Amazon. And the publishers of the book reached out and Rick reached out just to say thanks. And I was like, Rick, it was the Romancing the Stone, I read your books, right. So there was that connection made. And then the thought came into my mind, since I was a screenwriter, it's like, these would make great adaptation material. And, Will and I had been writing together this was about 2021, I think this was going on. And Will and I had been writing together since like 2020, and talked about like, hey, this would be pretty cool. We approached, I approached another company called Stampede, and got them really excited by it. And I knew, I didn't have the deep pockets to option the books, but I knew that they did. So I partnered with them. And we approached Rick and we approached the publisher, and at the same time, Rick and I were becoming pen pals, and I met him when he came out, and a real friendship was growing. But ironically, because of that Twitter thread, I think, and because of the profile, all of a sudden there were all of these other companies that were after the rights to the books at the same time. So I ended up unleashing our own competition. And it was, would you say, like probably a year and a half of negotiation and us almost losing it a couple of times. But, and some of the other offers were much bigger, but at the end of the day, it was Rick putting his foot down and saying, these are the guys who get what I'm doing. These are the guys I want to go with. And we just felt so privileged and blessed to be entrusted with telling those stories by Rick.
I mean, Will, for you, what is that like? What was that moment like when you guys were actually tabbed to do it? When it was like, okay, you, Will and Zach, you guys, here are basically the keys to the castle, to these incredible stories, and you get the opportunity to bring them to a larger, wider audience.
It was overwhelming. It felt like really exciting, but also a tremendous responsibility. It felt like the perfect confluence of my like artistic goals and my ethical goals to work on a project that is, these are exciting adventure stories. They're really compelling in terms of their characters and their narratives, but it's also hugely important, pardon me. And so to have both of those things at once, where it's a story that will be fun to tell, but also is really important to tell and deeply meaningful to me and to Zach. That was that's a moment I'll never forget.
And I mean, are these, how do you approach a film where animals are a pivotal part of the, because just filming wolves in captivity a lot of times is nearly impossible. So how do you approach that?
I will just preface this by saying we have to tread very carefully here because while the scripts are done, we're still in the process of setting it up, and we don't want to give away too much. But what we are allowed to say is that it's a really innovative, is that the technology in the last 5 years or so has emerged,
yeah,
that suddenly you don't have to get a wolf dog and, wave a stake in front of his face and try and get a performance out of him. you can, you know, if you saw what Jon Favreau did with the Lion King remake and the Jungle Book, all of a sudden the technology is there and it's just getting more affordable to do to do performances of animals that are photorealistic but are generated by computers, so you can get whatever performance you want. You can have them do whatever you want. And I can say that the plan right now is to utilize that. The plan is to utilize that technology for the wolf side of the story, so that we can actually, you know, there's all that great footage in a lot of cases of the things from the books, but it's from a mile away through a telephoto lens. And if you're recreating it in a computer, all of a sudden you can do close-ups, you can do different camera angles, you can have tracking shots, you can use the whole toolkit of filmmaking and not just be bound by what footage you were able to shoot through a, you know, 300 millimeter lens from a mile across the Lamar Valley.
Wow. Yeah. And without giving anything away too, you did hit on something really challenging for us as writers. How can we tell this story with wolves as the main characters?
Yep.
You know, it's one thing with text, but something else on the screen to make these narratives coherent.
Yeah.
I can't explain what our solution was, but I do think we've come up with something that's hasn't been done before and that people will find really exciting.
Now, I know for certain movies or you know, movies, documentaries, TV, whatever, when they're kind of, I don't want to say when the concepts are sort of fragile or they're, you know, there's a lot of elements to this wolf conversation. There's the conservation of it, the politics of it. What kind of specialist might you have to consult that'll help you get this story right? And is there a conservation element to the film version of these books? Because of course there is in the book.
There's a huge conservation element that was a primary goal of this. We want it to work as a story. We want it to work as a drama. We want people to be emotionally compelled by it. But the whole point of this is to be able to have hopefully millions of people be able to see these wolves through the same eyes that Rick saw them through, and see them as these incredibly unique beings with these amazing inner lives who are, you know, important in the ecosystem and worthy of being protected. And in terms of research and things like that, obviously there's reading Rick's books. There's reading another big pile of books by other authors about about wolves in general. And then, you know, one of the biggest things that we did, frankly, was, you know, go to Yellowstone and spend a week with Rick. I was able to talk to Doug Smith, another major person in wolf conservation, was able to talk to a lot of the park people who are still working at the park. As you know, I mean, I'm sure you've both been to Yellowstone. Like you drive slowly down that road through the Lamar Valley, and you're at one point or another, you're going to run into everyone because there's only one way in or out, and they're all there. And if there's a whole bunch of them in one place, usually right in the middle of them is Rick, because they all know to follow him, because he knows where, you know, he knows from, you know, 28 years of experience where they're going to be.
Did that help you? I mean, that trip to Yellowstone, does that help you make this film?
I mean, there would be, we couldn't do it otherwise. You know, I mean, I know for instance, when we wrote the first draft of the script, we used to talk about viewing stations for the wolves, because we didn't realize that you literally just pull over and view them from wherever they happen to be. You know, we didn't have the lay of the land in mind. And also just the feeling of being there. You know, it's difficult to put into words, but you can't write about it effectively until you've actually experienced it.
Yeah, you can say something like, you know, you can write the words. It's like an American Serengeti, but until you see the freaking plain of the Lamar Valley out in front of you, and there's antelopes, and there are the bison herd, you know, the bison herd, you know, slowly crossing the road in front of you and swimming across the river. And there, you know, you hear the wolf howls and the coyotes yip. It's, you know, it's abstract, and that makes it very real. You know, we're both, you know, there's a how soon can we go back element right now, even with life getting in the way.
American Serengeti is a really good book, by the way.
I mean, for you, Will, what is it? Were wolves at any point in your life one of those animals that caught your attention and like held a place that you were like, all right, hey, when did they become one of those animals that for so many across the country, around the world even now, that they hold this place of, you know, majestic spirituality, conservation, preservation? What was that moment for you? And Zach, you can answer right after too, but was that, what would, can you pinpoint a place where they really became the animal if it came to that point?
Well, I guess I get this story. I think Zach knows where I'm going with this, but so we were raised by you know, a single working class mother, and in every home that she ever inhabited, bringing us along, there was the same picture, laminated picture of a gray wolf on the refrigerator.
Oh, cool.
And she also had the Robert Redford narrated a vinyl record of wolf howls that was so big in the 70s. I've read somewhere it could be considered the most influential record album of all time because it really helped spearhead the wolf conservation movement. But that picture was always there. I can see it like in every minute detail anytime I close my eyes, that gray wolf. And you know, I asked her about it one time, and our mother grew up in difficult circumstances in foster care and in poverty and managed to come out of it. And she said to me, when I was raising you guys, I never had to worry about the wolf at the door because I let him into the house and made him part of the family.
Wow.
And that's all I can say about that. I mean, I'll never forget those words.
That's wild.
He said it all. It's you know, the even before we saw one, even before either of us ever saw one in the flesh, the wolf is a kind of benign figure, always loomed very large in our household.
What were those trips like? Well, that trip to Yellowstone, because obviously you ran the gamut. You see Rick, you meet Doug, you meet the biologists that are doing this work, the wolf watching community. Where does, one, are you guys officially part of the club now? Because you probably are, I would say, by default. But is there or are there any lingering, and I don't want to say pressure, but in a good way, for both of you to catapult these stories outside of this ecosystem where there is such a incredibly passionate base of individuals that are there every day or there multiple times a year that are continually watching these wolves, continually making sure that they are taken care of? Where is it considered pressure for both of you, or is it kind of a badge of honor to be able to take this to the next level?
I mean, it's both, honestly. You know, like I it is a privilege and an honor to have been entrusted with these stories, and you do feel the pressure. And, you know, like, we were never so nervous as when we handed the first draft, you know, before we handed it into our partners at Stampede, we handed it into Rick to get his read on it and to get his notes and things like that. And we're texting each other because Rick is reading the script and he's, you know, he's writing little emails, you know, it's like, I'm on page 60. It's, I just cried at this part, you know, da, da, da. You know, oh, you didn't know about this part of my life, but you guessed really well. And, you know, we're high-fiving each other over text because, you know, that meant the world to us that Rick was responding to it. And so you want to do right by Rick, you want to do right by the wolves themselves, yeah. You want to do right by that whole community. And at the same time, you're also handing it in to, you know, the Stampede is, it's the former head of Warner Brothers runs that company. It's like people who know movies, people who know TV shows, people who, you know, they like wolves, but they like wolves much more like a civilian who's out of that world does. So it was interesting and it was super useful getting their outsider's perspective because they were, you know, they were asking these questions that because we had been so in that world for so long, it didn't even occur to us. It's like, okay, well, why did they get rid of the wolves in Yellowstone? And why did they bring them back in the, you know, like what was the point of bringing them back in the 90s? Like we had just, you know, in the first draft, like we just treated those issues as givens. And so it was interesting going, you know, like having to go back and include things to, you know, make the story understandable to an interested to an interested outsider, to someone, you know, like someone who, knock on wood, is, you know, going to see this at an, on an, you know, at an IMAX, the, you know, at an IMAX theater at the local science center, you know, at, you know, who's, who's going to watch it as a big, you know, as a big streaming of, you know, as a big streaming event. And, you know, they know those wolves sure are pretty, but they need the context of like, what is the story of why they were exterminated from Yellowstone and why they were brought back and why, you know, what's happened since then, both good and bad.
Yeah. So, I mean, I assume you guys are learning a wild amount just about wolves and crash course on wolves and wolf history. What are some things that have really surprised you? Just, you know, wow, I didn't know this was an element to this.
I mean, from so much, it's hard to know where to start. But for me, I didn't know very much at all about the political situation in the northern Rocky Mountain states. And that's been a baptism by fire, you know, especially with what's in the news recently with the wolf pup torture incident. It only, you know, furthers, I think, our goals to reach people and to show the other side of the story. But I think, you know, and I think a lot of people have learned outside of that area who aren't in wolf conservation don't know that there's a war against wolves happening in those states. So that was a real eye opener. And I think, you know, there's two pieces to it. One is legal and political and policy driven, and the other is cultural. And we could talk about that for hours. And you guys have been talking about it for your last, you know, four episodes. But I do think about that in terms of our film, in that, you know, I don't know that a film can change policy, but I do think a film can affect people's mentalities. That affects culture. So I don't want to, you know, get too like ambitious with it, but you know, I do imagine a world where this is a really, really popular film series. And if we can't reach maybe the anti-wolf adults who are so entrenched in their belief systems, maybe we could reach some of their kids who just see these films. And say, wolves are neat. Wolves are crucial to healthy ecosystems. Wolves are individuals with a future they look forward to and a past that they remember. And so, yeah, learning about the politics around wolves was kind of eye-opening and earth-shaking. And then it just kind of fueled the fire for what this script could represent and what these films could represent.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say the other thing in terms of the wolves themselves, the thing that really surprised me from you know our research and in particular from reading Rick's books is the idea that each of the different wolf packs in Yellowstone had their own cultures in a way, and that different, you know, that wolves are not the same, that they have as many different personality types as humans do, and that they have different leadership styles. And that not only that, but those leadership styles echo through the generations and are taught to each other. There's you know, a section in one of the books that we try and dramatize some that, you know, where the Druid pack that we're mainly following is has fallen on hard times and is displaced by another pack. And then a third pack comes in and displaces both of them. And this other pack was unable to bounce back because when their den was put under siege, they didn't mount a rescue attempt. They just kind of gave up. And unfortunately, their pups starved to death as a result. Whereas what we saw from the Druids is, you know, because of leaders like 8 and like 21 and 42, they would do anything for the weaker members of the pack. And they, you know, they were actually able to bounce back after adversity in a way that I can't remember which one. I think it was the Slough Creek pack was not able to. So that was, you know, the kind of dynamism and again, it's very Game of Thrones in a way that the, you know, it's these, you've got to, and we do, we, you know, it's like, it's a big map of Yellowstone. It's like, and you know, here's the color coded territories of the packs, and you know, oh, here's the, you know, here's the invasion and here's the counterattack. And it's, you know, it's all, you know, it's endlessly fascinating in the way that human politics are.
So we said you went to Yellowstone, you kind of got the, you became tapped into sort of the flow of Yellowstone and how it works. In terms of the settings of the film, are you guys really emulating the landscape of Yellowstone in terms of the features, exact features, and trying to really, I guess, get that very specific and nuanced to Yellowstone, or is it going to just be a generic wilderness?
Oh, it's definitely, it's the Lamar Valley. Okay. It's Yellowstone.
Wow.
It's, you know, we can say that it's, you know, like there are specific geographic, you know, it's like, you know, here's Specimen Ridge. Here's what is it? Soda Butte Cone. You know, and I don't know, you know, it's early in the process, so I don't know if that's going to be captured by recreating it, you know, like recreating it in a computer, or if it's going to be shooting plates, you know, what they call shooting plates,
yeah,
where you photograph it and then add in the animated characters. It's too early for that, but it's the specificity of Yellowstone is very important to the storytelling. You can't set this story in a generic wilderness. It has to be in Yellowstone. And a lot of the drama of what happens is dictated by the geography.
That's wild, yeah. Man. In the beginning, we talked about kind of the challenge of writing a movie where animals are the main character. Do they talk? Is it narrated? Do you get, is that a secret?
I'll take a run at that.
Yeah, we need to be vague on this, but we will say that like Rick's line in the sand to everyone, to all of his suitors, yeah, was no singing and talking,
okay,
no singing and talking wolves.
I think we figured that much.
That was his non-negotiable.
That was his yeah, line of death.
Oh, wow. So I'm curious. All right, cool. That's cool, man.
So we can't tell you how we're going to do it, but we can tell you that
it's
that,
not a Disney film.
it is not, you know, there's not going to be 21 on the ridgetop singing, "Where Do I Belong?"
Or saying, "Wolf shall not kill wolf," you know, which as writers, we were totally down with that prohibition, but it was,
that's a hard one.
It was,
yeah,
challenging.
Do you get, I mean, clearly that's, you accept, cool, the, dude, challenge. I was good. That was going to be my next question, Stephen. So good idea for getting in.
Did Rick tell us that before? Like
he did.
I think he was saying, yeah, he refused to have singing and dancing if he's going to tell, yeah, the story through film. Oh, he did tell us that. Yeah. On the podcast. Yeah,
many moons ago,
yeah,
when we were
that,
talking about, he's like, I have suitors and, you know, about who want to get, obviously. And this was probably, honestly, this was right around the time.
Yep.
When there time was, I, you guys were involved and other people were involved at that. What, Will, what's it like just talking with Rick and getting these details? And like you said, the literally the line in the sand of certain things. And obviously you both have accepted the challenge, but how is it collaborating with an individual like Rick that has so much knowledge, that has all these sightings, that just, he's literally, you can just go to the well 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 times to talk about this. And I wonder what people are thinking about, you know, for both of you to be able to pick the brain, I would think, hopefully at any time that you want, obviously, because this is property, to make sure that this gets done the way you guys want to see it through and the way he wants to see it through.
Yeah, I mean, Rick, as you guys well know, is an exceptional individual. You've never met anyone like him. He was and remains in some ways a bit mysterious. I think for us as writers, one of the big questions was his 15-year streak of unbroken wolf watching. I think I got that right. He'll let me know if I don't. Hi, Rick. But, you know, on some level, that resembles an obsession. So I think as writers, we were sort of like, what's driving this guy to that level of commitment? You know, what's his hidden motivation? Like, what's he running from or something like that? And then meeting the man, spending time in his home, going around Yellowstone with him, I came to a very different conclusion that I think my brother shares, which is he just loves wolves.
Yeah, 100%.
I think a lot of us, most human beings on the earth, are searching for their purpose. Certainly me, and I imagine all of you, we have things we love. You guys have your sanctuary and everything else. But to meet someone so certain of their purpose on earth is incredible. And I think if you know what you're here for, why would you do anything else? And so Rick he's kind of pure of heart. I mean, the man has found his purpose and he's never questioned it. And he's an exceptional guy. We feel really privileged to be friends with him.
Yeah. I don't know what to add to that other than, you know, I mean, Rick is a great American and it's just, you know, it's fun, you know, like you're just hanging out with him and he's just a guy and a very interesting and singular guy, but you're also, you know, it'd be like, you know, getting to jam with Django Reinhardt or something, you know, one part of you is also aware of the fact that you're in the presence of a really, you know, of an amazing person and that his like will not come again. Mm. So, appreciate it. So yeah, it's been wonderful. What a great person to be able to call a friend. Yeah.
Another piece for me is early on, we were just getting to know him and the wolf world, and we considered him a wolf biologist and realized a little bit later that's not exactly accurate. He's sort of invented his own position as wolf interpreter. And I do think the man's a scientist. His data collection is rigorous and comprehensive, and you know, academics use it for their studies. But he's a bit like Jane Goodall in that he didn't have the same professional credentials as some of his contemporaries, but he just outpaced everyone with his time in the field. And then to take that data and weave stories out of it, he invented that job, you know?
Yeah, that's a great correlation, actually. Well, I didn't even think about that. Zach, I want to ask you something because you're in the superhero world in some of your writing and some of your producing. And we talked about Game of Thrones, and that's always the stories or the show, I guess, that gets wielded around when we talk about wolves and we talk about these incredible experiences and these, you know, like you say, these attacks and, you know, defenses and things like that. Did you draw anything from your dabbling in the superhero world with X-Men, with Thor, Flash a little bit, into the writing of some of these characters and seeing maybe some of the parallels without ever reading these books prior to going into those projects and putting that into what you and Will are working in right now?
Oh, if I hadn't, I do now, if for no other reason than Rick is a big superhero fan.
Is he?
And he loves superheroes and he loves Godzilla. And he'll talk about it. It's like, you realize that the relationship between 21 and 302 is a bit like Thor and Loki. And you know, it's like, actually, that's a really good point, Rick. You know, and I keep, you know, like with 21, it's tough to, you know, when you have this, this character who is an unparalleled fighter, but who never kills an enemy. It's like, if you don't think of Batman, you know, I don't know, you know, it's impossible not to. So yeah, I mean, you know, I'm definitely drawing on that. I'm definitely drawing on that some, but you know, I sometimes think Rick sees the parallels even more clearly than I do.
It's so crazy to think about this and how, like, the, again, just the correlations of these stories and how there's so many interconnected webs and how this all works out for both of you. If you can, if there's any way to tease this or whatever, again, if we need to edit out, we will. When or where or how are people going to see updates, I guess, for production, for release? Obviously we're still in the stages, but just what's the, if you guys can, is there a timeline? Are you guys, is everything on track so far? What's the, I guess, the next step or the evolution of the project from where you guys sit currently?
There's a lot that we can't say. What we can say is that there are, the scripts have been, you know, the script has been written, and gotten to a place where our partners are very happy with it. What's going on right now is probably the most time-consuming part of any filmmaking process, which is quote unquote attaching talent. In this case, and we are letting, because of their great relationships, Stampede is taking the lead on that. And what's going on is it's being, you know, the script is being read by a very select group of actors and directors with the idea of attaching them and then taking that as a package to partners at either one of the legacy movie studios, by which I mean Warner Brothers or a Disney or a Paramount, or one of the new, you know, the streaming companies like Apple, Amazon, and Netflix, because then doing that and then producing it in conjunction with them. That's the plan, and you will see updates, you know, hope, knock on wood, as talent gets attached, as those partnerships get made, as it goes into production. You know, it's even if all of that happened tomorrow, it would still be a couple of years before we saw anything, simply because animation is incredibly time consuming and the lead times are long. I did a kids cartoon for Netflix based on Jurassic World, and that was, you know, that took 2.5 years. This is much more cutting edge. This is much more cutting edge than that. But you will see in the press updates as we move closer to production and as we, knock on wood, move closer to release.
Will, for both of you, what are the feelings been, or what are the reactions been from friends, people that you know that see that you're attached to this project, if they know about it, if they don't know about it? Have you started to give other people that you know, I guess, the entryway into this fascinating world, into this natural world, into this realistic world that actually exists, that's something that is not fantasy, that is something that you can literally go drive to, fly to, see, you know, and in certain places touch, not the animals, obviously, but just what are those reactions, feelings, emotions like for people in your immediate circle or even outside of your circle that you've been finding and seeing?
Well, it felt great to be able to talk about it when the press release came out, because I had to sit on it for a good year, you know, which was hard because I'm so pumped and proud to be involved. You know, as far as like educating the people around me or their feelings about it, that depends on their tolerance for listening to me talk about wolves for hours, which I can do, you know. To be honest, I think some people are baffled. They're you know, they're like, how does this work as a movie? And I have to sort of explain that about Yellowstone, about the stories Rick has managed to observe and tell. So I think there's a certain amount of befuddlement among some of my friends of like, I don't get it. Is this a documentary? Is it a nature show?
Right.
I love to explain it over a couple beers if anyone's, you know, if any of my friends are into that. I do have other people in my world who are wildlife enthusiasts who get it as well. And also I'm active on Facebook and I write about wolves a lot on there and have gotten a lot of exposure and feedback from people both in the broader wolf advocacy world and not. So that's been rewarding.
I mean, we have the timelines, we have this. I'm sure you both have seen that. I haven't stopped smiling this entire time because this to me is extremely exciting. Having read these books, having met Rick, obviously not with the personal relationship that you both have with him, but just really understanding, I think, the importance of stories like these, natural stories like these, to come to the forefront and for the masses to really see the beauty and the importance of the biodiverse world that we live in. And so for you both to be able to share this on a wider scale, even if it is a few years, Zach, I think it is, I think the anticipation will be there. I know that people that we run in the circles that Steve and I are in are going to be absolutely, I mean, ecstatic, I think is probably the only word I can think of to really come down to when this thing finally comes to final fruition.
I mean, probably the fact that it does take time and the fact that these, you know, that nothing is fast is probably the most frustrating and difficult thing about being involved with this, because you feel a little bit, it's a little bit like, you feel like the scientists who are working on the Manhattan Project and, you know, like one of them, one of the physicists, he was getting letters from his brother who was fighting on the front lines in Europe and knew what he was working on. And it would just say, hurry up. And when you see stories like the horrible one out of Wyoming and you see how many hearts and minds need to be spoken to and need, you know, you see how much something like this in the popular culture is needed, it makes you just chomp at the bit to want to get it done and put it in front of people.
Yeah, I think that's a really big piece. What Zach just said is that, you know, it's easy for people like us who are involved in the wolf world to think of it as all these things as a given or as things that most people are thinking about, but they're not. This is a very niche subject to the average American, and popular culture can change that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, the update, whenever you get updates, if there's stuff that you guys want to talk about that you ultimately can, as time goes on, you know, obviously we're here to help promote, help and do whatever we can to reach the broader audience, to reach the people outside of the purviews of the four of us here on this podcast. My last question for both of you, I'll start with Will, and then we'll go to Zach, is when you hear the word wolf, what is the thing that comes to your mind?
Dignity, just the intrinsic dignity of the animal and its sanctity and its crucial importance to our world. We can't lose the wolf.
Zach, what about you?
I close my eyes and I visualize that wolf on the refrigerator door from when I was 3 years old. And it's this, this is when I'm going to get all touchy feely and woo woo. It is definitely this totemic animal that feels like it's been watching over me my entire life. And that this is my way of, and this is our way of hopefully giving back to an animal that's meant so much to us for our entire lives.
Thanks, Mom.
Yes.
Moms. Wow. They're
good
so
job,
great.
Mom.
Yeah, thanks, Mom. Will Stenberg, Zach Stentz, again, just, I can't the amount of times I've had spine tingles up my back here with both of you. Really appreciate you giving us what you can and cannot wait for this project to see the screen. You guys are fantastic. The Alpha Wolves of Yellowstone, they're coming. and we will keep you posted.
Well, I want to also thank you guys. I love the podcast. I look forward to hopefully both of us meeting you soon. And also your questions were really great, and you're good at your jobs.
Thank you very much, man. Appreciate that.
Thank you for both sides of appreciate what you do.
Really, thank you guys. It means a lot. Really appreciate that.
Can't wait to see you in the Wolves in person.
Oh, definitely. You guys, like I said, you guys figured
and
out
the premiere?
And the
absolutely.
Premiere.
You can bring that. You can bring them. They'll be your plus 44.
I love it. That's it. We got the invitation, folks. Oh my goodness. Hang tight for one sec while we sign off, guys. How's to y'all out there? We'll be with you next time. Bye, everybody. Looking for more information about Wolf Connection or the podcast? Please visit our website at wolfconnection.org, where you can donate, sponsor a wolf, or become a volunteer.